Welcome back to episode 112 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we love to highlight and dive into the glories, and guess what? We will get to today, but we also look at the plateaus and the pits of despair, which, unfortunately, it looks like I'm back in. Wow, that pit is deep and terrible and scary. So many adjectives I could put out there. All right, if you want to support the show, you can go to Patreon Chess Journeys. I do want to thank the Queen Level supporters, Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Donna Rich Burgess, Brandon Hullside, David Schreiber, Lindsay Newhall, Jeff Peterson, Nobody Rex, Bob Berger, Nicholas Harrigan, Rich, Bradley Fenner, Fletcher Ray, and even the King Level supporter, Ian Samples. I have only been streaming a little bit now on Dr. Skull _ Tiny Grimes. I am back in school. I'm trying to juggle all of the pieces of my life. If you want to appear on the show, a great place to go is the Google form in the show notes, or DM me on Twitter. Those are the two best places. And if you're interested in improving your chess, Noel Studer's Next Level Training Program is a great place to go. And if you use the code in the show notes below, well, guess what? You get to help me out too. We all win. All right. Speaking of winning, I want to bring on our guest this week. We've got FM Nate Solon. He's an author. He's a chess coach. He is a recent chess tournament champion. He is Mr. Everything. I imagine he's pretty happy on top of that. Nate, welcome to the show. How are you doing? Have you played any chess yet today?
Thanks. Yeah, good to be back. I have not. It's always hard for me to answer this because I do sometimes compulsively start a one-minute game without my conscious brain even being aware of it. So I probably have done that a few times today. I don't know if that counts. Apart from that, I have been working on, you know, I had one coaching session. I did a little work entering my games into my database and like a little bit of review, a little bit of opening stuff. But I believe as far as actual chess playing, a few sort of involuntary bullet games was it.
Okay. I guess let's start there then. I'm curious. When you say you were looking at your tournament chess games, like, do you do the Jesse cry, like type up 1,000 pages and spend 17 hours per game? You do, you know, 10 minutes, you do something in between. What's your process like?
No, I'm not that disciplined. I do try to not look at the engine evaluation during the tournament. I was pretty good at sticking to that this tournament. I think, I like to be able to enter my notes of what I was thinking and considered during the game, sort of fresh, you know, untainted by knowing all the right answers from the engine, because once you see those, you can't unsee them, and it tends to kind of color your memory of what happens. So, and I also think if you're the type of person who's given to self-flagellation and that sort of thing, you know, when you check the game with the engine and you inevitably find you made a lot of mistakes because that's what happened every game, then that does give you a bit of an avenue to start beating yourself up, which is not helpful. So yeah, I try to, during the tournament, I just try to relax and focus on the next game. And then I started putting all my games into Chessbase and just putting in a few notes or reflections of what I was thinking during the game on the plane back home, actually, just to kind of pass the time. And then, yeah, then today I was looking a little bit with the engine to see what the truth actually was, where, you know, what I missed.
Gotcha. When you say you're putting your thoughts in, are you able to remember all of those? Like, for myself, if I play like a 6-round tournament, by round 4, I don't remember what I was thinking round 1. Like, I have a couple of them, but the thoughts aren't as vivid. Are you able to sort of remember all of your thoughts, or are you doing it after, you know, a certain amount of games you're putting them in?
No, well, I do generally wait until the whole tournament's over to start putting them in. I wouldn't say all, definitely not all my thoughts, but kind of the big ones, like certain lines I calculated, like, you know, often it's the case that you go for a line or don't because of like a very specific point, you know? So it's like you calculate some line and you realize like, oh, on move 5 of the variation, like this happens and I lose, so I can't do that. You know, so if there's something like quite specific that I calculated that caused me to make a decision, I'll probably remember that. You know, certain positions, certain factors in the position that were like very troublesome to me. You know, often there's a line or a piece or a something that's like really bothering you during the game. That tends to be pretty memorable for me. So it's just sort of those like most salient things. Those I remember, but yeah, there's some things that are just sort of a blur that I can't reconstruct.
Okay. And you don't think it's that important to get like every feeling of every move? It's more like really going for the important stuff.
Well, I mean, it's just not possible, right? But so I don't think you can possibly reconstruct everything. But one thing I do think is very important is to be honest with yourself about what you were really thinking. And that's another side of not looking at the engine first, because then once you have that, that's just going to give you more ammo to kind of fudge your recollections. One thing I've been thinking lately is like, what are the hidden sides of chess talent, right? Because we would think of, you know, someone who's a very fast calculator, maybe great memory, absorbs information very easily. But I think there are hidden sides too. One of which being like a capacity for honest self-reflection, where you don't minimize your mistakes or like make weird excuses or make up weird thoughts that you really didn't have during the game. But at the same time, you don't beat yourself up excessively. So I think something that a lot of people who are able to improve seem to have in common is like, they're kind of able to look at their own games with like a somewhat clear eyed, dispassionate sort of gaze and just kind of be like, yeah, okay, that was a mistake. Here's how I'm going to improve that without getting too, you know, too evasive, but at the same time, not really going out of their way to beat themselves up.
Yeah, I feel like I'm really good at the honest part. I'm not so great at the dispassionate part, right? Like, especially if I put it in right after the game, some of my commentary is rather scathing. Like, how could you possibly think this? Are you like, is something wrong with you? You know, those are some of the comments you might see in my analysis. A couple days later, I'm a little bit more dispassionate, but you know, it's challenging. Real quickly, with what you said about like, once you put the moves in, it's hard to remember what you were thinking if you turn on the engine. I played a game last night. I came right home, immediately put it in, and accidentally had the engine on. I usually don't do that. And there was a moment in the game where he took a pawn with a knight, and I did not take back the pawn, take back the knight with a pawn. It was a free knight, but like my king was still in the middle, and my queen was being on the same file as a rook. And so I was like, freaked out about all these things. And then the engine was just like, of course you take the knight with the pawn. And so then I couldn't even remember what I was worried about. I was just like, I remember being worried, but I can't remember the specifics now because the engine has like erased that from my mind and just put in my mind that you're a moron and should have taken that knight.
Yeah, exactly. That's the reason to kind of wait on. And I'm not someone who says don't use the engine ever. I think it's a very powerful tool. Actually, it's really important to learn how to be more effective at using it. That's a big chess skill. But I like to do it only after I've at least got like a few notes down of my own reflections.
Yeah, that's what I like to. I like to put in the game, put in my thoughts, put in my feelings, put in my ideas. And then ideally, then look at it with my coach, then look at it with the engine as sort of like a third, like a secondary coach, but doesn't always happen like that. All right. Well, I think we should stop burying the lead here. So you went to the Alto tournament over the weekend, the at least 21 tournament. And from what Twitter said, you did pretty well. You did pretty well, Nate.
Yeah, I managed to take clear first. I had 5 out of 6 points. That ended up being, there were a couple players with 4.5, but 5 was good enough. So yeah, this was my first over the board tournament in over a year. So I can't complain. I was definitely not really expecting, you know, I wanted to have some fun and get some good experiences and catch up with some friends, but I was not really expecting to win it. So that was, yeah, unexpectedly good result. Some things broke my way. I played some good moves, some really bad moves, but enough things sort of broke my way in the end.
Okay. So my takeaway is don't play any tournaments for a year and then I'll just do better. Awesome. Thank you.
Yep, that's the secret. You heard it here.
All right. Well, I guess my first question is, were you the highest rated player in the tournament? Were there people rated higher than you?
I went in, I believe, as the third seed in terms of rating. Dean Ippolito, who's an IM, was there. He was I think he's around 2,500 USCF. And Alonzo Zapata, who's a grandmaster, who's in the 24. He and I are quite closely rated, at least in terms of USCF at this point. He was 2,400. I think he has, like, going into the tournament, he was maybe 1 point higher than me in the low 2,400s.
And did you beat either of them?
I won against Zapata.
Okay.
I did not play Ippolito in the tournament.
Okay, so you won the tournament. You beat a grandmaster. That's pretty great. Did any norms on the line, or were not all the requirements met? Oh, there weren't enough rounds, were there?
Yeah, this is only a 6-round tournament, so you need at least 9 rounds. So no norm possibilities in this tournament.
Yeah, the annoying thing of norms, right? You're like, I have a great tournament. And they're like, but how many people from different countries were there? And you're like, I don't know. How many rounds were there?
Yeah, well, I mean, for a lot of reasons, 6 rounds, but also I don't think the average rating of my opponents would have, I mean, to get a norm, I'm going to have to beat some even tougher guys, unfortunately.
How many grandmasters have you beaten in your career?
You know, I was just thinking about this. I think, as far as I can remember, this is only the second grandmaster I've actually beaten in a classical over the board game, which I think is a little bit weird. I haven't really had that many shots on goal. Like, I kind of stopped playing when I was a kid, right when I was trying to get up to that level, and I started in recently. So I really haven't had that many games total against grandmasters and over the board tournaments. So, you know, I certainly have a lot of, like, online blitz. You know, I had a win against Ikaru.
Whoa.
You know, and, like, I don't know, Eric Hansen. So, yeah, blitz, you get a lot more shots on goal. So I have a lot of good wins in blitz. But as far as OTB, I think it was only the second one.
Okay. Wow, that's pretty cool. So coming out of this event, are you, A, thinking, like, well, time to retire? Like, I did it. I did what I wanted to do. Are you thinking, no, it's time to push for IM, or anything else happening in there?
Well, I definitely want to keep playing. You know, I wasn't thinking about this as a one-off. One of the big reasons for me to play was I had decided that I think it's actually important to play at least a little bit if you coach. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of unhappy with how long I had been inactive. And I thought it's making it really difficult to empathize with my students as much as I really should. So that's one of the reasons I want to keep, you know, I have a 1-year-old, I do lots of other stuff. So I don't really, there's not a lot of tournaments in my area where, you know, where I could compete against players near my level. So there's a lot of reasons why it's difficult for me to play OTB very often, but I definitely don't want to have another year layoff. I'd like to do it somewhat regularly. And also, you know, I had sort of chalked this one up as, like, the warm-up tournament, like the practice tournament, you know, because the first time you get back is always tough. Now, I happen to have, like, a very good result in this tournament, but at the same time, like, there's a lot of stuff I could clean up, a lot of mistakes. I know I can play a lot better as well. So I don't want to, you know, I kind of want to let this good result, like, fuel some momentum rather than trying to rest on my laurels at this point.
Okay, nice. And your goal isn't, like, pushing for the next title, but more just being an active player, you know, being able to bring that to your coaching.
Yeah. I don't have any, like, specific plans to chase the IM or GM title right now. It's just really tough because of these requirements, like the 9 rounds and everything. Just thinking about this a little bit, because there's even, I just found out there's a norm tournament, I think in Nebraska, but the more I thought about it, the more these norm tournaments really don't appeal to me. So, like, this is all kind of inside baseball. I don't know, like, how many people are familiar with all this stuff, but basically once you get, you know, up to the master level, it's just a rating cutoff. So you just play your tournaments as normal. And if you do well enough, you get the title basically. But for IM and GM, it's a different system. It's not just a rating cutoff. You have to get these norms, which are like tournaments where you perform at a certain level and you need 3 of them. And there's all these weird requirements, at least 9 rounds. And then there's all this stuff about average rating of your opponents, like number of titled players you played against, what countries they were from. There's a lot of stuff. So it's just, like, hard to come by this stuff. And the norm tournaments are where it's an invitational round robin that is designed to, like, give you an opportunity to do this. So that's the route a lot of people go, but it just doesn't appeal to me because like a big thing for me to go to, if I can find time to a chess, to go to a chess tournament, like I want to have fun. I want to see a lot of friends, make a lot of connections. So to go to a 10 person tournament where I probably won't know, I mean, maybe I'll know one person just to try to chase this norm. And they're also very expensive. It's like $800 if you're a norm seeker. I mean, it's just brutal. So if I'm going to do it, I'll probably try to do it in an open tournament, like the World Open or the US Open or something, where I can at least go to a big tournament, see a bunch of friends, have fun. It's 9 rounds. So, you know, maybe if I have a great result, I'll get a norm that way. But I'm not like making a lot of decisions and sacrifices to chase that at this point.
Yeah, it just seems like the title system, it feels kind of outdated to me with such a broad swath of people playing chess now. It kind of feels like it's geared for like the wealthy elites, right? Who can put their life on hold for long stretches of time and pay a lot of money for hotels and fees. And I don't know, it just kind of is feeling more and more like a relic of the past to me.
Yeah. I don't know if you necessarily have to be wealthy, but it certainly helps to be like young and unattached to the point where, you could go, you know, go to like Europe for a year and just do nothing else but play tournaments and maybe, you know, support yourself off of, I don't know, just kind of like living quite modestly. But yeah, for an adult with a family, it's very, very tough.
Yeah. I don't have a replacement, by the way. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it feels like it's adding an extra layer of burden to the IM title, which I don't know. It just feels weird to me. Someone like you feels like I can't even really chase it because of the way it's set up. It just feels kind of weird to me.
Yeah, for me, I don't entirely understand why it's not just a rating cutoff. Like, I guess ratings can be gamed and manipulated to some extent, but I mean, so can these norm tournaments. Like, yeah, a lot of these tournaments are like a little bit. I don't want to like cast doubt on anyone because like most of them are legitimate tournaments, but there are some that are like kind of sketchy too. So, yeah, you know, I mean, every system can kind of be gamed a little bit.
Certainly lots of rumors at a minimum out there, right? About like people taking money to throw games and things.
And
like
even,
that.
Even if it's all on the level, like the incentive, because the standard format is the norm seekers pay and like the people who are already titled are paid to play. So that's all above board. That's just normal, but it does create some weirdness incentives.
Yeah. And I imagine tournaments love to invite grandmasters who tend to lose to norm seekers. Like that's
exactly
great for them.
Yeah.
So it's a very weird system at a minimum. All right. Well, I want to know how you prepped for this tournament. So you've got a big tournament. You scheduled it a while ahead, right? So you knew that you were working towards it.
Yeah, this is one I always like to like register, get my hotel, get my flight, like get everything locked in as far ahead as possible, just to give myself a little bit of motivation. And so I'm not, you know, I don't find myself the week of the tournament like deciding whether or not I'm even going to play and having that suck up emotional energy. So I definitely had it locked in for a while. I made a training plan, which I absolutely did not adhere to. A lot of stuff came
why
up.
Why not, like, though? Why didn't you adhere to your training program? You're a coach. You know how to train.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of reasons. Like, we had so I have a one-year-old. He ran into some sleep issues right during this runway to the tournament. So, like, first he started waking up at, like, 4 or 4:30 a.m. every day and not going back to sleep. Then he stopped doing that. But then it was like he was waking up at midnight and awake for like 2 hours before going back to sleep. So we had to work through all of that.
Did you reason with him? And you're like, now, son, listen, it affects you. It affects me. And he was like,
ruining my tournament preparation. Yeah, he wasn't too swayed by that. But he sort of,
that's too bad.
I don't know, the sleep stuff, you never know. Like sometimes it just resolves itself. So he's kind of back on a good schedule now. But that was very tough for like a little while.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you had a built-in excuse had things gone badly.
Yeah, I guess so. But I kind of, after that, I sort of had to revisit my plan, really downshift a lot of what I was trying to do and sort of think like what is the minimum I can do to be like sort of ready for this? So that's it for me. Like the two biggest things were openings, like getting a functional opening repertoire ready, because not having played in a year, I just had like bits and pieces of things I used in Blitz or prepared for students, but nothing really resembling a fully ironclad repertoire for myself for a classical tournament. So that was one thing. And then the other big thing was like calculation and especially getting used to seeing pieces on a real board. So I did try to get in some sessions of getting out a book with exercises, setting up the pieces, you know, some like challenging problems where I had to spend at least a few minutes to try to calculate and look at a board.
Where did you go for these sources? Is this like Agard and things like that?
This time I tried this book called, it's actually right behind me still, Universal Chess Training by Miranda. So it's, this is one of the ones where it's not only tactics, it's like a mix of tactics, strategy, any sort of position. That kind of appeals to me as, you know, because in a game, of course, you don't know when there's going to be a tactic. So that more game-like situation, I like that idea. I think at the end of the day, I don't think it matters that much where you get your positions from. It's not really about the positions. It's about the thought process. But, you know, that I think it's a pretty good book. It was, I will say it was very challenging. Like, it has three chapters. One is like what every Russian schoolboy solves. Two is, I think, these puzzles may bite. And three is like grandmasters wept solving these. I only even attempted the first chapter and I found them quite hard. So I think, you know, it's a good book. The answers have quite a lot of good insight. Probably not a book I would recommend for anyone below master level. Cause even that first chapter I found quite, quite challenging.
Yeah. That's too bad. Cause the way you described it sounded amazing. I was like, all ready to put it in my Amazon cart. But yeah, it sounds like it's probably above where I'm at.
I think there's another book that's pretty popular, I believe, by Ray Chang. I'm not remembering the title right now, but similar concept of it's a mixed bag. It's not only tactics, it's strategy, it's every kind of situation you might encounter. And I think that one is for, you know, not quite so high of a level.
Yeah, that one is amazing. The only issue I have with it, and it's not an issue, but it's that it's more of like a puzzle book, not a set the position up on a board book. Like the answers, at least from my level, are relatively easy to find. And you know,
so you need something in the middle perhaps.
Yeah, something right, and I need to find the sweet spot. So I don't know, we'll see what I can find. All right, so that's mostly what you did. Opening repertoire, did you go with your knight f3 on move one?
Yeah, so I have this chessable course that came out fairly recently. It's a repertoire for white. It's part of this series called 100 repertoires. So it's a full repertoire in 100 lines, which is compared to most chessable courses, compared to most opening books, is like very short and minimal. And yeah, it starts with one knight f3. I usually go for this setup with g3, bishop g2, castles, that sort of thing. And, you know, I really did not design this repertoire for me. I really designed it with more like club players in mind, but given that I certainly knew the lines very well because I had been knee deep in working on this thing for months, and I had this time crunch and I still had all my black openings to worry about, I just decided I would just play my chessable course. So that's what I did, and it actually worked really, like, surprisingly, you know, I believed in the line, so I didn't think it was going to be a disaster, but I was pretty nervous because it's very short, you know, compared to what most people would consider a master level opening repertoire. It's like there's really not much in there. It's completely in the open. You know, I was out there like tweeting about this and promoting it, and I didn't change it. I really didn't change anything. Like, I just played the lines from the course, so any of my opponents could just have looked at the course and known exactly what I would do. But I had four white games out of six rounds, so that was a little luck perhaps. But out of those games, I scored 3.5 out of 4. Really good positions out of the opening every time. I had wins against Grand Zapata, Grandmaster, and Dina Belenkaya, WGM. So overall went, I mean, honestly, better than I was expecting, but it worked really well.
Oh, what an advertisement. So you can take Nate's chessable course, even if your opponents know what you're going to play, you will beat GMs with it. I mean, that's a pretty good advertisement.
You know, I think oddly enough, I don't think any of my opponents like were even aware that I had a course. Like, I don't think any of them prepped in that way.
Okay.
Which I don't know. I guess I have to like market the course better or something. There was at this tournament, the pairings were only announced 45 minutes in advance. So there was not an enormous opportunity for prep. But still, you know, it's like it was right out there. So I do think it's something I tell people all the time, and I think this is just more evidence of that, is I think people are a little too paranoid about their opponents targeting them with specific prep and like, yeah, oh, I have to play like 8 different openings so no one knows what I'll play. I think most of the time no one knows much. And if you just know how to play your openings, you're doing great. So just, you know, choose a core repertoire and figure out how to play that well, and you're 90% of the way there.
Yeah, I definitely echo that. I mean, I play at the same club every week. I've played some of the same opponents 4 times, and my opening is fine, right? Like, even if they know what I'm playing, I know what I'm playing, and there's never a position in the opening where I'm like, oh no, they out-prepped me. If they do try to prep me, usually what happens is, like, if they do something cool, I play the wrong move anyway that they had prepped, and then they're out of their prep immediately. Right. I'm like, okay.
And experience counts for a lot too, because it's not only the opening moves, it's playing the positions, right? And if you always play the same stuff, you get a feel for it. Actually, if anything, my problems were more so with the black pieces, where I was using other people's repertoires and other things I had learned. I had actually, there's sort of a few funny stories about that. One is, so I was for this tournament, I was sharing a hotel room with my friend Todd Bryant.
Oh, Strong Chess.
Strong Chess on Twitter. Yeah, I'm sure people know him. So we were actually paired in round 2. Oh. So we were both, you know, we had our 2 queen beds in the hotel room, and we were both sitting on our respective beds with our laptops trying to prepare for what the other person would do.
Oh, that's amazing.
But, you know, my read on him is like, he is a very dedicated, like, he's an E4 player. He's an open Sicilian player.
Mm.
And I always thought, he's one of these guys who sticks to his guns and just plays his openings. I knew his online account, so I was like, I had like hundreds of his blitz games, and I was preparing. But the game I had black, it went e4, c5, knight, c3. So
okay,
I had only prepared for an open Sicilian, so he kind of got the drop on me. And then my other black game was against David Vigorito, who's an IM from Massachusetts. So I used to live in Boston, so I know David. We're friends. Now, I had sort of prepared a secret repertoire for this tournament. Well, my white repertoire was super not secret because it's my chessable course. But my black repertoire, I started, you know, the last time I had played a tournament was over a year ago, so I didn't remember anything. So I kind of had to start from scratch anyway. So I chose some black openings and like only played them on secret accounts.
Oh, that's
being cool. A little sneaky. But then the thing is, my opening against D4 was the semi-Slav.
Yeah.
And David literally wrote a book on the semi-Slav. So it was like, it was kind of an awkward choice against him. But my strategy going in was, I was committed to this narrow repertoire. I was just going to play my openings. I wasn't going to try to like scramble and do something else. So I just played my opening, and he went for a very critical line. I had been preparing in part with Sam Shanklin's chessable course.
Okay.
So in the line he went for, I knew there's a 25 move forced draw line, which I knew because it was, it's in, like, I do the spaced repetition. So I knew the line.
Okay.
But of course, once we started playing it out over the board, I was getting very, like, I knew the line, but I didn't really know much else. And so I was being very worried about a lot of different moves he could play that I didn't know how to deal with. Whereas he was playing slow and obviously finding his way. So, you know, he wrote this book, but it's been years ago now. There's a lot to know in the semi-Slav. So, like,
yeah,
he was clearly struggling to remember or find his way, but I didn't know if I was rooting for him to find the moves that I knew, which would lead to a forced draw, or a different move, which might be, you know, presumably would often be a mistake, but which I had no idea how to deal with.
Oh, no.
So that was definitely, I mean, this is such a cliche, but you kind of have to relearn it every time. But I really realized that, like, my preparation in the semi-slav was pretty shallow, pretty naive in certain ways. And I really need to go back and, like, fill in a lot more understanding there.
Interesting. So did you guys go for the 25 move force draw?
No, we played like something like 18 or 20 moves of it. He deviated. I pretty much immediately messed up. Then I found some really good moves to kind of keep the game going. And it should have ended in a forced draw, but on like the very last decision point, he chose the wrong king move that actually allowed me to win. He could retreat in two directions with his king. One was a forced draw, one lost, and he happened to choose the wrong way. So I managed to win. But you know, these are like the moments the whole tournament comes down to, right? You know, he chooses that, I end up winning, but there's always all these little moments that could have gone differently.
Yeah. Wow. So now I'm hearing you beat a GM, an IM, a WGM, and let's see, did you beat my friend Jay Garrison? I'm trying to remember. Did you say he played you or not?
I did not play Jay Garrison.
Okay. All right. Well, he's basically an IM, even though he's only like 1800.
Okay. All right. Future IM.
Future IM. There we go. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the Alto. To me, this is like almost the tournament I want to play at more than any of the legendary tournaments, because it just seems like such a fun environment of a bunch of adult improvers who are there hanging out, having fun, serious about their chess. What's your review of the event?
Yeah, it was fantastic. You know, I put some thought into which tournament I would play, like for my first tournament back, because like I said, you know, I don't get to play in these things very often. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to have a good experience. I wanted to catch up with some old friends, maybe meet some people I only knew through Twitter. And this was, I kind of put the word out, like, hey, what's a great tournament to play in? And a lot of people said, like, these Alto tournaments are fantastic. So, yeah, it was totally as advertised. It was fun. I think it was, like, a little more social and sort of collegial than your standard tournament where everyone is, like, crammed into, like, a hotel ballroom or something. It was, you know, there was one night where everyone got a free drink ticket, so people were kind of hanging out at the hotel bar. I got to catch up with a lot of people. Met a few people I knew from Twitter. So yeah, it pretty much went like I planned. It was a great event. I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, it's making me feel even worse about my decision. So what happened was I didn't think I was playing in a Labor Day tournament. I had marked off the Alto event months ago, and then I realized, school will just have started. How am I supposed to fly out and back in time? It's not going to work out. I'm just not going to play anything. And then like a week before Labor Day, my wife's just like, I thought you always played in a Labor Day tournament. Like, you should. And I was like, wait, what's happening here? Okay, I guess I should. And it was kind of too late to scramble together plans to go to the Alto. And so I went to, you know, a local tournament. But kind of what you're talking about, there's like a lot of emotional energy in the like, should I, shouldn't I? I've been sort of struggling recently. I said I wasn't going to play in any tournaments for a bit to kind of get my head on right. But can I really pass up the opportunity to play when it's given to me, when it's kind of rare? And so there was like a lot of energy wasted in that whole decision-making process.
Yep. Yeah, that's definitely something that's happened. Usually for me, if I'm not actually registered, if I leave that decision up to the last second, I'll just end up not playing. So I'll just be like, oh, it's too stressful. Like, whatever. I'll just watch some sports or something.
Exactly. I could just hang out with my family. That would be fun. What do you think about adult-only tournaments in general? Are you sort of an advocate of them? Do you want there to be more? Do you think it's a bad idea to sort of be removed from the whole playing base? What are your thoughts on them?
I think it's nice to have the option, and I think it appeals to a lot of adults. I mean, it is easier, honestly. Like, that's not why I chose this tournament, honestly. I just wanted to have like a fun experience. But like, yeah, the kids are really tough. It's very tough to play against these kids. So but I'm not thinking of this adult tournament as like some like weird way to get a competitive advantage or something. I just think it's nice to have like a social experience with adults. I think like with the, you know, this whole our crop of people who got into chess through the Queen's Gambit, there's a lot more adults who are newer to the game, and a lot of people who want to who want to improve, but also like if they're going to do something for a weekend, want to have like a good experience. Like they don't want to have like, you know, like there's only one bathroom and like the toilet's clogged and like you're crammed into this terrible room that's really hot and like, you know, this like terrible experience. And like, so I think there's definitely a room for something that's more adult, more social, like a little classier, not to like replace tournament, you know. I don't think like kids like should not be allowed to play or something. Like, yeah, kid, like there's a lot of kids who are great at chess and they're doing great and that's awesome. But I think it's just nice to have this option. Like one way I think of it is, I think like a lot of chess tournaments are like a marathon, like incredibly exhausting, like really grueling, just about this sort of all out effort. And like, I think we need some 5Ks too, you know, like not everything has to be this like,
yeah,
psychotic competitive venture where you just punish yourself to the maximum. So I think we need a little more of that. I think adult tournaments are part of it. At least a few, so people have the option.
Yeah, I like that. I also kind of think of it as like we have scholastic tournaments, right? So there's environments where kids can feel comfortable just playing against kids, especially if you're newer to chess. I think it's kind of intimidating for a five-year-old to get paired against an adult. And I think it's kind of the same with adults. There's plenty of adults who are, you know, newer to tournaments and are sort of intimidated to be paired against a kid and would rather play an adult.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I think it's a good option. I hope some more clubs start doing it.
Yeah, me too. I kind of feel like the Chess Journeys podcast is like an adult improvement podcast. That I feel like this podcast should host a big adult.
Yeah, you could do like a theme tournament or something.
Yeah, I think that might be something I'd like to do. How about if you're interested in that, let me know. I could bring in all the guests. They could get free entry. There could be like a signing room where, you know, the guests are signing autographs. I don't know. I don't know how that would work.
Yeah, you should do it. I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, I think it would be fun. Okay, so you're in favor of adult tournaments. I'm happy to hear that. All right, man. I could talk to you for like 7 more hours, it looks like. Let me ask you just a basic question then. Why make a chessable course? It seems like it would be so time consuming. What was your motivation for doing that?
Well, I think they're actually kind of fun for me to make because I like doing opening research. You know, some people like to study the opening, some people don't. I think it's fun. I think it's actually a great way to exercise some creativity because, yes, there's the engine, there's the database, there's sort of the paths that have been trodden. But then using all those tools, there's a lot of creativity in choosing a path, you know, figuring out what's going to work against certain players. So that's actually a lot of fun for me. And it's something I do a fair amount on my own anyway. So I can take a lot of like the opening work that I would do anyway. And, you know, as if I take detailed notes and write good explanations, you know, that's getting me a long way towards having an opening course.
Okay.
I mean, there's also, if we're being honest, there's also a monetary aspect to it of like, if you are a professional chess person of one stripe or another, you know, there's a certain number of ways you can try to make a living off of that. Chessable as a platform, it's like a lot of people visit that platform. You know, they have like a certain amount of sales and marketing, a certain amount of eyeballs on that. So, you know, for me to do that is probably going to make more money than if I just like do my openings and like, I don't know, sell them as a PGN or something. I don't know how many people would really find out about that or want to buy it.
Yeah, and it seems like they have a really good arrangement with authors as well, where, you know, unlike a book, which you get this tiny sliver of the sales, it feels like you get a lot larger percentage on Chessable, which is great.
Yeah, you get a pretty good deal. definitely compared it. Like, I mean, I also have a book which I self-published, which, like, I mean, that was a cool project. I'm glad I did it. But as far, you know, if I were to calculate out like the dollars per hour that I ended up making by writing a chess book, I mean, it's not going to be very inspiring.
And it's such an awesome book too. Evaluate.
Yeah, like, yeah. I think it's a good book. It was a fun project. You know, my co-author Eugene Perelstein, like, really awesome player. Actually, he also just returned to OTB chess after not playing for a while, and he won two tournaments in a row. But
oh wow.
Anyway, yeah, it was like, it's an awesome experience to write a book. But yeah, if you're trying to maximize your hourly, writing a chess book is not what I would recommend, unfortunately.
Yeah, at times it almost feels like a vanity project, right? Like, you know, you're going to make almost nothing from it. It's going to take a ton of work. You're just hoping like people love it at least, right? So I will say this, I love it. Everyone I know who has used Evaluate like a GM loves it. So I've never even met someone who's done it. Fine.
I think we had a pretty original idea, and like, I'm proud with how it turned out. Yeah, it seems like people like it. I hope it's, you know, it helps people improve for the people who use it.
Yeah, I say waste your time and write a sequel, man.
Because I've got some ideas. It's always like, I mean, I have a lot of ideas. It's always hard to choose the next project, but yeah. Got some more book ideas. There's a pretty good chance I'll do some more Chessable courses. Just like, I've done this white repertoire now, so I'm thinking about doing a black repertoire, probably in two parts, but I still have to figure out exactly how I want to go about that.
Just do a semi-slav in 100 lines. It'll be fine.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, you know, I want to do this approach of like minimal, kind of offbeat. So unfortunately, actually, black versus D4 is really the toughest nut to crack. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to figure something out.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I heard you on the Perpetual Chess podcast with, I can't remember his name, the statistician. Maybe you can.
Jeff Sonas.
Jeff Sonas. And you all were talking about rating deflation more in FIDE, because FIDE, you know, maybe is going to do something where suddenly they're just going to give me like 150 points out of nowhere, which, interestingly, I personally am not a statistician. But that feels like the biggest band-aid ever, where it's like, we're not going to fix the problem. We're just going to give a bunch of points and hope that it helps the problem. But I'm just curious, with USCF, any thoughts on rating deflation in that rating system?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, as far as giving away the points, it is actually, so there's the one-time points, and then there's some adjustments to how the ratings are calculated, which, like, giving away those points, it does sound like a blunt instrument, but actually, like Jeff wrote this paper about it, and I found it pretty convincing. Like, he really had quite a lot of data. He ran these sort of alternative simulations. It's actually quite readable too, like his proposal to FIDE. You can go and read it. Very, very readable, no technical language really. So very interesting, not too long. So people can check that out, but basically he has access to a lot of data on this. He did research, and the upshot of it is that the whole point of like the ELO system is, like, given a rating difference, it's supposed to predict a certain result. And in actual fact, it's not working right now. The lower rated player is winning way more than they're supposed to. So basically what that means is, like, whenever you play against a lower rated player, mathematically, you are expected to lose points. So it's really not supposed to be how it works. It's kind of a problem. As far as USCF, to my knowledge, no one has done like this comparable research with USCF ratings. So it seems likely that a similar thing is happening with USCF, since, you know, similar dynamics are at play of, like, young, underrated, fastly improving players joining the system. USCF uses a similar system, not exactly the same system as FIDE, because, like, every federation and website that does ELO ratings tends to do them a little bit differently in terms of exactly how they're calculated. So it's not exactly the same, but it's pretty similar. So my guess would be, yeah, something similar is probably happening with USCF ratings.
Okay. That's an interesting question for me, of like, should I care and like obsess over it? And it feels like the answer is no, because it doesn't get me anything, right? It feels like I just got to kind of play and accept what's happening as what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you really want to try to like use this information to benefit yourself, the thing you would do is seek out higher rated players to play against, because it's a two-way street. If the higher rated player loses points, lower rated player is supposed to gain points. So in theory, you perhaps improve your chances to gain rating points by playing against higher rated players.
Yeah, and anecdotally, that's worked very well for me. Playing up in big tournaments, I almost always win, you know, 30 to 50 points. And then if I play at my club where there's a whole bunch of underrated kids, or play in my range, I tend to lose points. So yeah.
So yeah, I guess it's sort of up to everyone how much they want to try to prioritize that, or how much you can really control that as far as who you're playing against.
Yeah, exactly. So I learned, I think, a valuable lesson this weekend at the tournament I played in, where I had been playing up a section and I was like, well, I might as well play in the under 1800. I've lost so many rating points. I'm near the bottom of the section, so it'll be fine. And so I got paired against a bunch of people who are rated like 1650, three kids in a row. And as I'm playing them, I'm realizing like, you are the same strength as the 1850s I had been playing. Like, you're not noticeably worse. I put our games in the engine and the engine's like, yeah, they play the same percentage. Like, I'm like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this then? This is ridiculous. I might as well play the same level person with 200 more rating points.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. Yeah, these kids are tough.
It's a weird system we got here, Nate. Okay. So you would agree, it seems like there's some deflation, but you know, either do with it what you want. You can either obsess over your rating and play up, or you can do what I'm doing, which is like, whatever. My rating will drop to like 800, and then I'll be really underrated and it'll be great. And I can be the underrated kid. All right. So let's move on to the last topic of the day. I played in a tournament this weekend. It didn't go very well. I went 1.5 out of 5, which, funny enough, I've had similar results lately where I played up and then I gained rating points. But in this tournament, of course, that I lost a lot because I was in my own section. But I've noticed something interesting is that, like, I do all this training, and my training regimen going in this tournament was like, really work on tactics, some calculation, not really openings, I'm pretty confident with them, but really kind of hone those categories. And then as I was playing, it just felt like that is not what I was losing on. It felt like I was mostly losing to more non-chess things like fatigue and hallucinating a piece is trapped. And I'm not sure that doing more tactics or calculations helps me fix these types of problems. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are for like training stamina. It feels like that's the hardest thing to train, because that is the event itself would be the high stamina, long tournament kind of scenario. I'm not sure how to put myself into that to train.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few different things you can do. One would be doing just longer and harder calculation training. Because if you're at home and you actually do, I mean, say an hour of calculation, that's very hard. If you can actually do an hour of focused calculation, I think in many ways that would be harder than a tournament game.
Oh, okay.
So you might consider working in some like very challenging, very focused, very intense training like that. That's part of it. And then, I mean, if you're experiencing a lot of fatigue, I think there's a whole other side to it of like health, fitness, you know, sleeping well, eating well, being in good physical shape. I actually do take those kinds of things like pretty seriously at a tournament. So like for this tournament, you know, I brought like my foam roller and my little lacrosse ball, so I can do, you know, do my little foam rolling in the hotel room. That kind of helps me feel relaxed. You know, I try to like eat healthy at like order something with like a lot of protein and vegetables and not like you know, not like a cheeseburger or something.
Yeah.
Generally don't like to drink at tournaments, although this was a little more of a social tournament. I got like peer pressured into a few drinks here and there. But in general, you know, if I'm trying to win at all costs,
yeah,
you know, drinking's not going to help.
I'm usually pretty good about it at tournaments. Like, make sure I get my sleep. I guess the big issue for me is it's hard to keep up my sort of exercise regimen of like doing an elliptical for, you know, 20 minutes a day and walking another, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 steps. It's kind of hard to, or at least it's been hard for me to do that. Like, especially like this hotel was like at the LAX airport. And I'm like, this doesn't really seem like the area where I can just wander around at night and get a nice walk in.
Oh no, I don't work out at the tournament. I just work out. Okay. I try to work out like regularly in my day-to-day life, but I don't worry about that at the tournament. I mean, maybe it would be good to do. I think I did see a few people like going to the hotel gym at this tournament, which is cool if you can do it. But I think it's more, as far as the physical fitness part, I would say it's more about what you do when you're not at the tournament.
Gotcha. And I usually eat carefully, but I will admit this tournament, it kind of slipped away from me. I was kind of like, one day for lunch, I had like a greasy piece of pizza. And then that dinner, I wasn't really hungry for a dinner. So I just like got some French fries, and then I got hungrier later and had like a bag of chips. And I'm like, what kind of meals were these? Like, this was ridiculous.
Yeah. I get one other thing that comes to mind is I think it's pretty important to have rituals at the tournament, like, you know, a pregame ritual, which doesn't have to be elaborate and it's going to be different for everyone, but maybe going for a short walk outside, meditating for a few minutes, like breathing exercises, whatever you think, whatever gets you like in a state, you know, where you can be calm and focused in a state of mind to play. One other thing I think about is like being capable of being relaxed when you can be at a tournament. So being able to relax when you're not playing, being able to like even relax somewhat during the game when it's not your move or when you don't have to calculate anything, because I think being sort of like low key stressed for a long period of time is extremely fatiguing. So that's a difficult thing. I think it partly comes with experience, but the more you're able to relax when you can, makes a big difference.
That makes me feel better, because I often get up and kind of walk around when it's my opponent's turn, and I always feel guilty about it, because I'm like, listen, you don't have this many opportunities to be at tournaments. Maybe you should be burning every ounce of energy you have on their move to think about every, you know, possibility. I tend not to do that quite as much.
Yeah, I'm also someone who tends to walk around a lot when my opponents are thinking. I just don't think it's possible to be in like full on max power calculation for 4 hours. No one can really do that. So whether you're sitting at the board or walking, you're not going to have the same level of effort continuously throughout the whole game. This is something I struggled with a little bit in this tournament, because it was my first over like classical tournament in a long time. And I had several games where my opponents thought for a very long time in positions where I didn't have much to think about. Like, either I was still in my opening preparation, or it was just like, I thought, quite a normal position where I didn't really have any big decisions coming up. But my opponents, you know, just in a few cases, like, thought for like 30 plus minutes on one move, where I was very surprised. And I was just walking around, but it kind of took me out of the game, because like, I was walking around for so long that like, I almost got out of a state of mind to play. It was a little bit difficult for me to get back in the game. So I might have to give some thought to like what I actually want to be doing when I encounter that scenario, because yeah, it kind of disrupted me in this tournament.
Yeah, I had that with one opponent where we were playing a very positional, normal looking Karo Khan, and by move 18 they were down to 1 minute, and this was a game 100, and I was just kind of like, what is happening with this guy, right? And it was funny, because it was a kid, and before the tournament he had said, just so you know, I play a little slow. And I was like, oh, that's great. Like, a kid that plays slow, good for you. Like, that's why you're so good. And boy, he was not exaggerating. And then it was really annoying, because every move he'd go, draw, draw. And eventually I was like, hey, if you could stop offering draws, that'd be great. I'm not, you're at 1 minute. I'm at an hour and I'm comfortable with this position. There is not going to be a draw happening.
Yeah. It sounds like, yeah, this kid maybe has some stress issues of his own. There's, there's actually, there's a grandmaster from Massachusetts who does this, Alexander Ivanov, who does this all the time. Like he always, like every game he spends, just randomly spends like 50 minutes on some move in the opening. But then the infuriating thing about that is like, I've had tournaments where like he did that against me. I got completely taken out of the game. And then he started playing really, really well with no time and beat me. And then like the next round, he does the same thing and like blunders and loses to like a 1900 kid because he has no time. So like he just blunders, but yeah. It's kind of, it's like a little bit of Russian roulette. It can be frustrating to play against, but I don't think it's a good strategy at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree. Last night I had a spot where it was only game 55 and it did go very long. And I thought I managed my time well, but at the end, I was playing on the 5 second increment and my opponent had 32 minutes and you know, I had to play a whole end game on the 5 second increment for like 28 moves. And I actually won the game. It was quite remarkable because he fell into that trap of like, oh, I'm going to rush him out. Right. Like I'm going to move fast too. And then he just kind of made one false step and let me trade off his pressure. And then it became a lot easier for me to play on the increment.
Yeah, this is what it came down for me. That's what it came down to for me as well. So the final round, Dina Belenkaya was leading. I was half a point behind. I had white against her, so I had to try to win. And I was able to put a lot of pressure on her throughout the game. But also, you know, it was just like a lot of the game was in this situation where I was like a little bit better applying some pressure, but I had nothing tangible. And it sort of went all that way into this rook end game where we both ended up playing on 10 second increment. So it was very tense. I ended up you know, winning in the end after various mistakes by both of us. So it was funny though, because that was when I told Eugene I was playing this tournament, his advice was to practice. He said well, like with this time control, it's going to come down to practical end games under time pressure, so you should prepare that. Which I was kind of like, you know what? Like, I never play end games. I'm going to prioritize openings and calculation. But of course, he was right in the end, which I did. I played one training session with Eugene where we played some end games with a rapid time control. So maybe that was actually the difference. I think that did help me, even though it was only one session.
Yeah, I know. I had a tournament game where I said increment, but it's actually a 5 second delay we play with. And I got to that and I just absolutely crumbled because I couldn't do it. And so I got my little daughter, she was 7 at the time. She got 55 minutes and I got 10 seconds with a 5 second delay. And we played entire games like that. So I could kind of get into that rhythm of like, okay, I know what it feels like, 5 second delay, 5 second delay. And then like 2 weeks later, I ended up in that circumstance and I won that game. And then last night I was able to win it again. So we got in the car and she was like, I helped you win that game. Like you did. You're the reason I won that game.
Nice. So I like that though. I like creativity in training is underrated. So like if you can get design something like that to address something, that can be a big win.
Yeah, I think that's the next step for me is to figure out, because this is the problem, is I don't even recognize that I am fatigued and I just hallucinate my rook is trapped. And maybe I wasn't fatigued, but I have to assume it's game 4, it's deep into the game, that it must have been fatigue that caused it, even if I'm not directly feeling it. Because I don't in my life normally hallucinate like, oh, there's a wolf there. Oh, there's not. Right. Like that's not actually a part of my life. So it feels like it must have been fatigue.
Maybe you can, I don't know if you do meditation at all, but maybe you could try that sort of a big focus of many branches of meditation is actually just to be more aware of what you're experiencing.
Interesting.
It'd be interesting.
Yeah, maybe. I'm definitely open to creative solutions to dig my way out of the pit of despair. Though that sounds like I'm going to go deeper into the pit of despair if I start digging. So maybe a ladder. A ladder is what we're looking for, Nate. Well, I think we've had a lot of good advice today. My takeaway is get Nate's chessable course on one night of three. You beat grandmasters, you beat WGMs, like you beat everybody. That's the answer to all of our problems.
Well, maybe not, but I do think it's a pretty effective course, like even more so hopefully at the club level, since that's what it's really designed for. It's pretty short, it's not that hard to learn. So yeah, I think if people are looking for a white repertoire, should be pretty effective.
I'm going to be honest. I try very hard never to buy new courses because it's just too tempting for me to keep chucking my opening repertoire and trying something new. But it's actually very close to what I play already. So I think I'm going to at least go through it and see if it can augment or perhaps, I probably shouldn't announce. Maybe I'll start playing new repertoire because then everyone will know what my repertoire is. But I'm definitely going to give it a very close look. It sounds like a compelling course. I love the short courses. The Shanklins and Gearys of the world are just too much for me. They're just too much for me, Nate.
Yep. I mean, I think I actually use Shanklin's course for my semi-slob, so it has good stuff. But to be honest, I pretty much did the quick starter and maybe a little bit of the rest, but that's what I was able to find time for.
I hear that. Well, Nate, thanks so much for coming on. I'm so thrilled for you. You are a champion, the official Alto champion. So maybe that will be me at the next one winning the lower section, but I don't think I'll be able to win the open. So congrats, Nate.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, everyone out there, I hope this is the week where you get your rating high, you find the ladder and climb your way out of the pit of despair. But if it's not, don't worry. Come back next week. We'll have a new guest for you that will give you some tips, some thoughts, some advice, maybe a new opening repertoire. I don't know. Maybe that's what you're looking for. I'll see you next time, everybody. Have a good one.